Welcome to episode 21 of GovX Data Points, where we talk all things government and data. I'm your co-host, Eric Reese. This week, joined by my colleague, Catherine Klosik, as co-host. Recently, Catherine and I sat down for a conversation with Johns Hopkins University Professor of History, Dr. Nathan Connolly. Dr. Connolly is the Herbert Baxter Adams Associate Professor of History at Johns Hopkins and author of the book, A World More Concrete, Real Estate and the Remaking of Jim Crow South Florida. Dr. Connolly writes and teaches about the politics of race in American cities, especially focusing on the built environment. In our discussion, we covered a variety of topics, including the history of policies of segregation and the lasting impact on neighborhoods. In addition, we focused on solutions that cities today can implement to help correct some of these issues in the long term. With that, we'll hand it over to our conversation with Dr. Connolly.
So welcome, Dr. Connolly. We're really excited to have you with us here today. I'm going to start out asking about a resource that you developed on mapping inequality, redlining and New Deal America. You presented it at the 21st Century Cities Symposium recently. And I was hoping you could just tell us about the tool and where folks can find it if they want to take a look and that kind of thing.
Sure. So mapping inequality is part of the American Panorama Mapping Project. It's basically a historical mapping project. And they run it out of the University of Richmond. So you can go to AmericanPanorama.com and find any number of historical maps, mapping inequality being one kind of subset. The organizers and I, who include Robert Nelson at University of Richmond, Richard Marciano at University of Maryland, College Park, Dale Wendling at Virginia Tech, and myself, all came up with this kind of crazy idea maybe 4 years ago to just fish out all of the security maps that were created by the Homeowners Loan Corporation as a way of creating the base of a national public conversation about redlining. Historians have, for the last 30 years or so, known about these maps. They tend to work on them on a city-by-city basis because they're very difficult to get to. You have to go into the National Archives in College Park. You have to get a reader's card. You have to be subject to all of the pull times that can make it very difficult to get material in a timely manner. And if you're lucky, in the span of doing a kind of urban history project, you're maybe looking at one or two cities as a snapshot of redlining. So what we decided to do was to get 150 of these maps that existed in the National Archive, digitize them and make them available for the public by way of the web. And the programmers that we worked with, again, I'm primarily kind of a historical consultant on a lot of the material and did some of the conceptual work, you know, came up with the title and thought a little bit about how the maps could be rendered. But we had some programmers that were run by Professor Nelson, Professor Marciano, Professor Wendling's teams at these respective sites. And it was a massive programming effort, basically. And they did things I really couldn't describe in much detail because I don't have the tech chops necessarily, but geo-referencing and, you know, creating a series of layers to the website where you can look at the paper map as it would look in the archive, mapped onto the physical city itself. You can then drag a cursor that would cause the paper map to fade away, and you would just have the colors mapped onto the contemporary city. There's also a diagram that's off, usually to the right, that has what was called at the time a kind of concentric circle model or the human ecology model of urban development. And that's actually where we get the term kind of inner city or outer ring from. It's a concentric circle that has downtown surrounded by inner city neighborhoods. And then flowing out from the inner city, you have a series of more residential communities. Well, this is a map or a model, I should say, from the 1920s. That in very, you know, eerie fashion actually previewed what became the redlining program and the redlining maps of the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. So we included it so you could actually get a sense of just how intentional it was that people were thinking in terms of which neighborhoods were attractive and which neighborhoods were unattractive. The last thing that I'll say about the site in terms of an innovation is that we included what are called the area descriptions. So if you think about redlining and you think about the districts that get carved up into the respective colors that are supposed to reflect mortgage risk, you have each individual neighborhood with a corresponding area description. What that basically is a one-page summation of that neighborhood's profile at the time that map was made. And it tells you things like what the average income was of the residents of that neighborhood, what the racial breakdown was, what some of the kind of impediments were to that neighborhood being given a higher grade, or what, you know, made sure that it got a lower grade. And one thing I'll say about these area descriptions that really blows people away is there's a line on these pages. And again, this is the federal government's, you know, housing program that basically asks for what the percentage is of Negro occupants of any neighborhood in America. That was a critical variable of whatever you were going to determine as that neighborhood's value. We found out more recently, just by looking at some of these maps and the area descriptions more closely, even over the last couple of weeks, that planners were not just looking at numbers of African Americans, but also looking for quote unquote subversives or subversive racial groups. That in fact, the presence of communists was also a critical like data point for planners to figure out what neighborhoods were going to be worth, right? So our hope at least is that, you know, through the Mapping Inequality site, you'll have people looking at every single neighborhood available for the 1930s and early 40s and come up with some really great new interpretations of how segregation worked.
And as a follow-up to that, I'm really curious as to what conclusions and lessons planners of today can draw from the experience and, you know, the discrimination of the past, right, in terms of so that we're learning both, you know, descriptively what happened, but also taking lessons so that we can change our practice in the future.
You know, it's a great question. I mean, one of the things that becomes really clear when you start looking at some of the supporting documentation around the redlining maps or even the Federal Housing Administration's underwriting manual is it was presumed that real estate's value was relative to its desirability to white buyers, a white population. It was kind of a default understanding that what makes a neighborhood attractive or not is going to be kind of shot through the prism of what your average white American might imagine to be attractive or not. Sadly, that hasn't actually changed a whole lot. When I was doing some research for a lecture I was giving on C-SPAN's American History TV, I decided to do some field work and just go to Greenmount Avenue and see where it ran up against Guilford. And one of the things that you found pretty quickly is that there are, one, physical barriers along Greenmount Avenue separating one part of East Baltimore from the more kind of leafy suburb or inner ring neighborhood that is, you know, Guilford. Secondly, the more you travel in from Greenmount, the higher the property values get. So you have houses that are right on the edge that are $400,000 cheaper than houses that are literally 200 to 300 feet inland. Same square footage, same basic architectural features, right? So there's a way in which we, almost without thinking, have set our property values in relation to what the perceived desirability is of your average white buyer. I actually had the experience of going with a realtor. Me and my wife first got to the campus here at Johns Hopkins, and she, you know, was kind of aghast when she made a wrong turn and wound up on Greenmount, right? As if, you know, Hopkins faculty shouldn't be interested in living anywhere over in that side of town. And so this is a kind of like folk knowledge that now exists, and it doesn't have the same kind of visible representation of the redlining map, but it's still a very common feature of like racial steering practices today.
So digging in a little bit more to the application of this data and displaying it in this geospatial way, I know that during the 21st Century City Symposium, we heard from Mayor Yarber of Jackson, who spoke about using data to tackle blight. And he talked about how in his city, a lot of times that's caused by neglect. And you've written about developers historically using low-quality building materials and segregated neighborhoods, leading to urban neglect. Right. Here at GovX, Eric and I and our colleagues work with cities around the country whose leaders are committed to revitalizing these aging neighborhoods, reversing declining property values, different issues related to housing affordability and blight. And of course, as you mentioned, in many cities such as Baltimore, these neglected neighborhoods are a direct result of redlining. What would you recommend to those mayors, those city leaders who wish to undo the damage in those neighborhoods?
Right. So, you know, the textbook term of blight is actually one that people tend to misconstrue, which is that, you know, blight simply means that property values have stopped going up, right, in a given space. So there are neighborhoods where the property value has literally topped out that aren't called blighted neighborhoods, right, because they don't have a certain population living there, or they're not seen as being kind of an emergency space. In fact, the redlining maps themselves were meant to simply reflect those neighborhoods where property values were no longer increasing. So the first thing that's kind of shocking, right, is to ask people not to simply presume that property values are going to keep going up, not to make that necessarily a goal of whatever kind of urban plan you put forward, because, as we know, certain kinds of demographic concentrations keep property values from going up because we're operating with your average white buyer in mind in terms of what makes a valuable neighborhood, right? So neighborhoods might be functional, they might have high occupancy rates, they might even be well serviced in terms of infrastructure, but because they're considered to be undesirable to the average buyer, in quotes, they're not considered to be anything more than a blighted neighborhood, right? So the first thing would be to actually have a radical reinterpretation of what we consider to be neighborhoods of value. Secondly, would be to think about a kind of urban policy that is much more mindful about the inflationary impacts of different kinds of urban redevelopment projects or not. And what I mean by that is this. When property values go up, they affect the way that property is assessed, the kinds of property taxes that people pay. And there are many people for whom high city taxes are already as high as they can stand it, right? So to increase the value of particular neighborhoods can have a very quick expelling effect on older populations, particularly, you know, senior citizens, disabled people who may own their own houses, but have basically been paying the property taxes that are maybe 5 or 6 or 10 years earlier than they might otherwise be if you reassess those neighborhoods. So one of the things that has to become really clearly articulated as part of redevelopment projects going forward is a kind of fairness in the tax structure that wouldn't put the burden of reassessment on those populations that are already paying large percentages of their income for housing costs. Secondly, I think we'd have to be aware of when we have larger redevelopment projects, like say the Port Covington project or any other number of big redevelopment schemes that might have an inflationary impact on the city as a whole, to put safety measures in place that would make it very clear that folks who might not even be directly displaced by the project won't again be priced out of their neighborhoods by virtue of either increasing rents, other kinds of instruments of gentrification, or again, property taxes being reassessed. So blight is an absolute problem, and it's a problem largely of, you know, in many instances, people who are using zoning variances or using the difficulties of people to move out of neighborhoods to provide them with safe housing. But there are other bigger problems around blight in terms of how we respond to it that require safeguards against people being priced out.
One thing that I've seen, as blight is a key issue, I'm from the Midwest, from the Rust Belt, where blight is a very common problem, where we saw a lot of flight from inner cities, and so now there's a lot of empty blighted properties, essentially in downtowns of cities, where cities are trying to take action to remediate blight, to make the downtown more attractive, most likely under the same assumption to the average white buyer.
Right.
But what would you say that cities can do to put those safeguards into place where you are going to have responsible development in those downtown areas? And I'm specifically thinking about my own context, right, in the Rust Belt of the Midwest, to really make sure that that development is responsible and responsive to the needs of the communities that are still there.
Sure. I mean, I think one thing that can definitely happen is encouraging people to build co-ops that allow them to pool resources, so you don't simply have kind of individual frontiers, families kind of coming in and trying to speculate and sometimes turning properties over that wouldn't be invested in the neighborhood itself. I think you can have, you know, much more careful kind of zoning initiatives that wouldn't simply have, you know, high-end commercial being the default way that you would change a neighborhood's character, allow for small businesses to come in and, again, encourage entrepreneurship of a much kind of smaller character than, say, the big box retailers that tend to be some of the first, again, like tips of the spear in gentrification efforts around the country. Another thing that you can do is just make sure that you have very good kind of code and building enforcement so that you don't have the deterioration kind of set in certain places. I mean, obviously, you have to be very careful with code enforcement because it can also adversely affect older homeowners in some of these neighborhoods. But, you know, anything that really, you know, places a target on landlords and the ways in which landlords can sometimes try to maximize their profit margins by virtue of not keeping up their properties in a way that they should would also, I think, be really helpful, right? So, you know, the last thing I'll say is the extent to which that this is, you know, possible, and, you know, to do it as often as possible, is to encourage mixed income, you know, developments, right? I mean, to really be clear that, you know, housing and location is not simply the privilege or the prerogative of the wealthy, but that, you know, having, you know, closeness to public transportation or having proximity to, you know, good schools should be a benefit that is democratically distributed, right? And so, you know, policies that are very clear about, you know, 25, 30, 40% affordable housing can be transformative for a neighborhood and really allow it to take on a really safe and secure residential character.
some cities that have made attempts to create mixed-income housing communities have had adverse effects, either, you know, intentionally or unintentionally. Mm-hmm. Do you have any recommendations for cities that are looking to develop or update such an affordable housing policy?
Can I add one thing onto that mm-hmm. question, too, that I think is fascinating in today's context specifically about mixed-age developments, which I think is related to mixed income in mm-hmm. some ways. But actually, I'm seeing some cities start to develop policies where they're actually trying to encourage senior citizens and families with young children to live in similar areas, and because it creates a variety of things for quality of life purposes.
Right.
But I think it's related. So I don't want to steal Catherine's question, but...
Well, and I think implied in my question is also kind of how do you get folks to that, you know, are from various incomes or from various age groups or various races to not just live next to one another, but to really integrate in those, you know, mixed developments.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you raise a really great point about kind of, you know, using senior citizen housing or even, you know, things that are friendlier to, you know, families with younger children, right? I mean, so much of what was even a fear in the 1930s when these security maps were first being drawn was about like the dangers of interracial contact, right? And what kinds of populations are considered to be dangerous or considered to be kind of spurs of white flight, right? So one of the things that has to kind of happen is, you know, creating a series of measures that would, one, allow mixed income to also be interracial housing, to create amenities that would allow families who might be on, you know, fixed incomes to, you know, take advantage of real public services, right? There's also, I think, baked into this, sadly, an anti-tax rhetoric, right, that believes that the only way that you're really supposed to encourage you know, growth is by offering kind of tax breaks to people to come in and invest tons of money, as opposed to actually having, you know, moderate property taxes where everyone's paying into the community chest. That would include servicing, you know, new public spaces, better public schools, better infrastructure, right? So providing real services for people will prevent some of the environmental degradation that gets associated with so-called slum communities from basically setting in, right? And again, you know, it's really important to keep in mind that when people think one about mixed income housing, what they think about is the creation of these slum developments. They don't think it can ever be sustained. What they don't understand, of course, is that slums are not the making of the residents themselves. They are a product of underinvestment on the part of property owners writ large. So if you have landlords who are, again, maximizing their returns, that's going to create a condition whereby, you know, housing deterioration will set in, right? Or if you have a situation in which the policing, you know, in infrastructure there is, you know, not one that's based on community policing, but based instead on a very kind of, you know, zero tolerance, broken windows approach, it tends to create a much more kind of anxious environment for investors and for occupants. So you have to have a kind of holistic approach that would be willing to take into account, again, how, you know, not just individual buyers or homeowners who might be in low income housing are going to behave, but even those folks who might be willing to venture a little more capital to like engage in speculative real estate, how they might be causing some of these neighborhoods to go, you know, to go downhill. The last thing I'll say about it is, you know, part of what becomes really critical when you see this in cities like DC, you see this even now in certain neighborhoods in Baltimore, is even more affluent families will be willing to live in income diverse communities if they believe that they're going to be able to take advantage of certain services. Because the big secret that nobody wants to really talk about is that many, like, middle to upper middle class families are also relatively hand to mouth in terms of how they're living, right? Most people don't have 8 months of reserve in the bank, right? And if they can get a great public school as opposed to paying for private school, then they're going to do that. So I think one of the things that you can certainly do to create, you know, middle class buy-in is making sure that whatever school is associated with a mixed income neighborhood is a great school and has the kind of investment that would make it attractive to families that would have some options to go elsewhere.
We talked about a couple different data points that can help show, you know, where these neighborhoods are that are succumbing to these issues, and also many different strategies, including public safety, including taxes, including schools, right, and that type of thing. For our mayors and city managers that might be listening, how can they prioritize where to start? What would be your recommendation for them to start thinking about really involving the community and coming up with a solution to these issues and kind of that prioritization?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, it's really important to keep in mind that one of the most consistent impediments to creating stable cities is the fact of, you know, economic predation, right? I mean, you really do have to regulate the ability of speculators to go into neighborhoods and carve up single family homes and turn them into rental properties. You really have to try to curb the ability of people to kind of snatch homes from under, you know, distressed buyers through like tax lien sales, right? You have to, you know, be very aware of price gouging in stores or to provide even, you know, much more effective, you know, food infrastructure in neighborhoods that are served primarily by like corner stores as opposed to like, you know, good supermarkets. I mean, there are a variety of different ways in which predatory practices being directed at marginal confined populations are going to make it very difficult for anyone to really do anything that's going to do, you know, long-term good, right? Mm-hmm. So you end up coming up with these, you know, large kind of land re-engineering projects as a way of trying to, you know, save a city, again, like Baltimore, or you think about other projects elsewhere, you know, think about what's going on in Detroit, Michigan, and a few places. You know, these kinds of projects are helpful, but they don't get rid of the predatory environment that gets associated with concentrated poverty. And so that to me is the job one, right? It's to create a regulatory environment that makes it much harder for poor people to be taken advantage of. And this is, you know, frankly, you know, a consequence of our post-1970s moment is that it's become less and less practical in the minds of many city officials to create viable public options for any number of things, right? Post office banking for those who have to use kind of check cashing stores, you know, food services that are less driven by these kind of speculative markets that are, you know, basically the corner stores. You know, you go to any number of, you know, commercial outlets, like, you know, durable goods stores that, you know, don't have really good price controls, frankly. And, you know, I mean, you would be amazed to know, for instance, in Baltimore right now, you, if you go to Mondawmin Mall and try to buy a pair of shoes, you'll see two things. One, you'll see a stock of footwear that is the same in every single store. Not just like One Foot Locker and like, you know, Finish Line, like having similar shoes, but like physically the same shoe in every store in the shop because it literally is like run like a cartel, right? Managing supply. The second thing you'll see is that when you actually go to buy a pair of shoes, you're haggling like you're in some street market in like Central Africa somewhere or like in Latin America. The prices themselves aren't set. It's a completely predatory market. And this is in a shopping mall, in Baltimore City, in the city limits, right? And so that's just, you know, one example among many of people who have no sense that there actually should be rules protecting them against this kind of activity. And it's about things that are far more substantive than like footwear, right? It's about medicine. It's about groceries. It's about childcare. I mean, all of these things can really be regulated much more effectively if we make the regulation of predatory practices a priority.
So I'm curious, kind of as we wrap up, you know, today, really two questions. One, what are some places that are doing this well that you think are good examples that people can follow if there are such examples?
Right.
And two, what is a way to get politicians, our city leaders, to think long-term? Because these are long-term problems that require long-term solutions, and yet we live in a political environment that's very short-term, very what's going to happen tomorrow,
right?
I got to get reelected.
Right.
So I know that those two questions aren't really related in any way.
Yeah.
But I'm curious as to what you think on this.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think in some ways they are related insofar as, I mean, one, sadly, I think, I'm very hard-pressed to think of places that are dealing with, for instance, the predatory problem very well, right? Because the idea is that, well, we've come up with market-based solutions to solve these problems. We'll let kind of capital go in and provide the services that we need. And, you know, by and large, most people are operating from the same playbook. I mean, this is the thing that's becoming really clear with the Mapping Inequality Project, right? Is no matter what cities you look at, you have the same basic principles of redlining being implemented from one city to the next, and it's being funneled through what federal regulations exist or what don't. The second thing is, you know, in terms of long term, I mean, part of it has to really be a question of what do you want the city to look like? I mean, if you want every city in America to be what Lower Manhattan looks like now, where it's totally unaffordable, where you have, you know, massive amounts of inequality between schools, you don't have a really well maintained, you know, set of guidelines to let, you know, the poverty that might exist on the fringes of the city now, you know, to be, you know, healed and basically addressed. And instead, you know, you want to try to figure out what's the way to get the next big box kind of, you know, enterprise into your city. That's going to be a short-term solution. I mean, even, you know, projects now that might be based on 40 or 50 year tax abatements are still ultimately kind of short-term solutions because they want to project that there's energy. They want to spur a kind of speculation and investment. But what you don't have is a real kind of question about what's going to be the long-term consequence for everyone living in the orbit of this community over several decades, right? So if we have, for instance, you know, an investment of, you know, $600 million in one part of the city, and it has an inflationary impact on the rest of, in this case, Baltimore City, you know, what are we going to do to make sure that residents can stay in their homes for one, two, three generations? Are we simply trying to do what they're doing in DC, which is to kick poverty out to the suburbs? Or are they really trying to find a way to make Baltimore a place that has, you know, high occupancy, a larger population, but again, that is income diverse in nature? I mean, this is a question that we really have to think through. And the last thing I'll say about this, and this is, you know, a sad fact, is that even when you think about these large scale projects that are based largely off of tax cuts on the one hand, you still have to pay the bills on the other hand, right? And so in the case of, you know, Baltimore City, at least, you know, the tax breaks that have gone towards one project in the case of Port Covington have been accompanied with a 33% rate increase in water bills for everyone in the city, right? Because the water infrastructure is crumbling. So that, to me, is not a long-term vision. You can't keep raising the property taxes, or the water bills, I should say, on people in order to get you to deal with what is the biggest long-term issue, which is whether or not you have functioning infrastructure in this city. So, you know, a lot of these problems can be solved, I think, if we just change our relationship to the tax structure, what we consider to be appropriate federal spending, and, you know, what's the responsibility of local and state and federal government to regulate, you know, the uses of capital to provide goods and services in the economy.
In the 21st Century City Symposium, the question of power kept coming up.
Yeah.
Sort of reminded me of that when you talked about the responsibility of government. So communities that we're talking about, you know, are living in neighborhoods that are a result of governmental decision-making, mm-hmm. and folks in power. So what can governments do about, or do you have recommendations for local leaders on how they can engender trust in those communities once again? Because there is a power dynamic going on. And even if a mayor is working for the good of residents, how can they really get that community trust?
Yeah, I mean, the number one way to engender trust, in my brief experience, has been, you know, and this may sound like a kind of cliche, but it's really important, is accountability, right? I mean, to whom are city officials accountable, right? I mean, to who do they report to? Who do they provide resources for? You know, who are their constituents, really, right? I think you have a lot of, you know, cynicism about city governance because, you know, for instance, the police departments aren't accountable to the communities that they're serving. City council people are rarely accountable to their constituencies, right, in any direct way. And, you know, accountability looks like not just, you know, taking soundings from these communities and their representatives, but also, you know, knowing that whether or not you win the next election, that your job is to provide goods and services to a very, you know, large slice of the city, not a small number of, you know, kind of moneyed interests that are supposed to then generate kind of wealth and jobs for everybody else, right? And again, this is a radical, you know, problem insofar as the way that we believe that growth happens is not by allowing small families and households to have greater wealth, because otherwise we would have done that. Instead, we believe that you're supposed to consolidate wealth and create jobs, right? And so, you know, part of what may happen, and this could certainly be the case in terms of national politics with, you know, the election, and certainly, you know, what happened around the Sanders campaign was a certain kind of groundswell in this effect. But, you know, to really get back to concerns about the household wage, and, you know, the economists are actually pretty clear on this, that if you take the resources that might otherwise be concentrated and, you know, distribute them towards larger numbers of households, that money will enter the economy and create, you know, broader prosperity. But, you know, we don't really operate in that way. And, you know, again, I think if you spread not just wealth, but you spread accountability, you get a better city. You get more responsive governance. You get more democratic practice.
Thanks again to Catherine and Dr. Connolly for joining us this week. If you want to learn more about Dr. Connolly's work, check out the links in the show notes and his book, A World More Concrete, Real Estate and the Remaking of Jim Crow South Florida. That's it for this episode. Thanks as always for joining us, and we hope you join us again soon to find out where the data points.